Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents From the Front Row, Reflections of a Major League Baseball Owner and Modern Art Dealer by Jeffrey H. Loria. Narrated by John McLean. Great baseball players have much in common with great artists. Both put their talents on the line, and neither is easily stifled by criticism. And both possess an innate ability to focus on their objectives and block out all distractions. Indeed, exceptional talents in all fields share these common threads. This book is the story of my twin passions for art and baseball, two worlds that are not nearly as different and separate as they may seem. To me, a baseball stadium has much in common with an artist's studio. Both are places filled with drama, suspense, and magic, and I have always felt wholly at ease in either a studio or a clubhouse. For more than five decades, I have been uniquely privileged to witness truly exceptional talent from the front row. The excitement of watching and working with creative people has kept me on the edge of my seat, eager for more. What happens on a baseball field also happens in art, as well as in our lives. What we see turns into what we feel. I am deeply fortunate to have come of age in an era when art and artists were still very much a face-to-face and indeed heart-to-heart enterprise. Authenticity and admiration were not yet pitted against anonymous bidders shrouded behind phone banks at auction houses. I still marvel at how I was able, as a young man in my early 20s, to knock on the artist Edward Hopper's door in New York's Washington Square and have him graciously usher me into his unfurnished living room where he kept his printing press. Art was personal. In much the same way, I later had the good fortune to join professional sports, ultimately being at the helm of Major League Baseball's Miami Marlins during the twilight of the era of instinct, before athletes were so heavily defined by analytics and when managers could still trust their guts rather than having to work around algorithms. Of course, there have been challenges. The art world is a largely private place that prizes discretion. Art dealers support, encourage, collaborate with, and champion artists, while at the same time, they quietly help collectors and institutions find the perfect work, the object of deep meaning or visual delight. Being with artists inside their private working environments and studios provides an intimate, in-depth look at the creative process, which is powerful to behold. The world of professional sports is, however, the complete opposite. The public spotlight is constant and strong. Owning the Florida, later Miami Marlins, meant experiencing the gamut of emotions, from exhilarating, including a 2003 World Series championship, to challenging. But it was never dull. I learned to live with sensational headlines, and the highs of thrilling celebrations, and the lows of withering criticism. Often, the person I read about in the press and the person who I am bore no resemblance to each other. But for many who work in professional sports, that is, as the saying goes, the price of admission. I've been very lucky, beyond my wildest imagination, to have achieved success in two very different worlds. Like most people, my own life has been filled with peaks and valleys. I have known deep tragedy and adversity, as well as good fortune, with serendipity, timing, and chance playing their own parts. And I realize now that I was also making memories, which, of course, are the currency of life. I have written this book with the intention of not only sharing stories from my experiences, but of making those stories something that the listener can feel. In the process of navigating the arenas of the arts and professional baseball, as well as philanthropy, commerce, and education, I have also learned a thing or two along the way, which I hope to convey. If there is one overarching lesson I would like to share, it is that passion is the key. We may value art, or value athletic talent, in monetary terms, but we cannot put a price tag on passion. There is no substitute for it in work and in life. When you are passionate about your work, regardless of whether it involves multiple interests or even seemingly contrasting ones, a drive for excellence becomes the common denominator. If I had pursued only my interests in art, well, I would have done okay and had a great life with extraordinary experiences. Knowing and working with many of the world's most famous artists has indeed yielded a life of curiosity and satisfaction. But like most people, I have had more than one interest. Yet I didn't stop to worry if these different interests would clash. Instead, I realized that the knowledge I had gained from the art world, including how to navigate myriad rules and guidelines, could help me to achieve even greater success in baseball than I had ever thought possible. Here, I hope that some of my experiences might inspire listeners and share with them the varied ways of reasoning and seeing that can help anyone to realize their own victories in their own realms. Some of the earliest lessons I learned growing up in New York City, and later as a student at Yale, were to always keep an open mind and continuously look and listen. We are all actors on a stage, but we are also the audience to the greatness that finds its way into our lives. If we take a seat in the front row, we have the opportunity not only to witness the best in life, but also to learn how to call the plays that will ultimately move and shape our world. JHL, New York, 2022. Chapter 1. Dreams Do Come True. The greatest danger for most of us lies not in setting our aim too high and falling short, but in setting our aim too low and achieving our mark. Michelangelo. I have experienced other epic moments in stadiums and ballparks across the country, but this day is different. It's a clear, crisp late Saturday afternoon in October 2003. My mind is racing and my heart is thumping with excitement. I am sitting in the visitor's dugout at Yankee Stadium, waiting for the first game of the World Series to begin. Imagine, the little Florida Marlins ball club, with a payroll of $54 million, going up against the mighty New York Yankees with their $164 million payroll and storied history, including such legends as Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Joe DiMaggio, and Mickey Mantle. I have chased this dream virtually all my life, first laboring extremely hard to work my way into baseball by purchasing a minor league franchise, and then eventually owning a major league team. This was a unique championship series. It was the 100th anniversary of the World Series, and widely advertised as such. The Yankees were appearing in their 6th World Series in the last 8 years. Having amassed 25 championships, 39 pennants, and a veritable brand name status, the Yankees were in a league of their own. For the Marlins, this was our second trip in 6 years to the postseason, but our franchise was only 10 years old. We were also the first team to be led by a 73-year-old manager, the incomparable Trader Jack McKeon, who ultimately became the oldest manager to win the World Series in the history of our national pastime. For some of our players, this was also their first trip to the hallowed Yankee Stadium, and it was evident from the outset that our opponents were masters of intimidation without even trying. The pinstripes alone conjured up apprehension. From the moment we arrived at the stadium and descended the stairs to the visitors' clubhouse, large signs reminded us of who was in charge. Joe DiMaggio's sign, declaring, "I want to thank the good Lord for making me a Yankee," stared us in the face before we even took our first steps to the clubhouse level below. That sign, however, made me smile. I had grown up an excited Yankee fan and was now walking those venerable halls with my own Florida team. I still get goosebumps just thinking about it. It looked, however, like our players did not share my eager emotional state. Sitting in the dugout observing batting practice with Jack and then watching our players return from center field's Monument Park, where they had glimpsed the bronze faces, plaques, and sheer number of Yankee legends, I realized that the Marlin players seemed intimidated and not their usual confident selves. To further make the point, the public address system was blasting Frank Sinatra's iconic song, New York, New York, while the Jumbotron highlighted the Yankees' prior glory in black and white film. It was supremely brilliant, and not at all subliminal marketing. As the players descended into the dugout and headed to the visitors' clubhouse to prepare mentally for their first inning, I could see anxiety written all over their faces. Although I too was anxious with anticipation, I felt we had come so far, and after so much hard work, that fear and failure were not options. I told Jack that I sensed a problem and asked if I could speak with his players. He replied, "Of course, they are not my players, they are your fucking players. Half of them don't even know if they are in New York or Hoboken." Jack encouraged me to take a few minutes to address the team, but I only needed 60 seconds. I got their attention by slamming a bat on the table in the middle of the clubhouse. As the players gathered around, I tried to convey to them that we belonged here in the World Series. We had earned it. We had been the hottest team in baseball since the All-Star break. I told them that we also deserved to be here because we were smarter, faster, younger, and better. I reminded them that all those greats in Monument Park had been their age at some point, but they were now retired or dead and could not play tonight. This was our time. We were going to beat the Yankees. And we did. During the New York week of the series, I stayed at my home in Manhattan, and I remember feeling the tremendous energy. Before the first game, on my way to the stadium, I stopped at a bodega on Madison Avenue and bought the New York Post and the New York Times to see what they were predicting. The headline in the Post read, "Fish Fry." Needless to say, we were the underdogs and not exactly beloved. When our team bus traveled up Madison Avenue, we were booed the entire way. As the series' first game began, emotions were elevated. When our experienced and talented leadoff hitter, Juan Pierre, safely bunted a fastball in the first inning, I had a strong premonition that more success was going to follow. But being superstitious, like many in baseball, I kept my feelings to myself for fear of jinxing our efforts. The Marlins won that first game 3-2. Our closer, Yugueth Urbina, pitched the ninth inning in his usual heroic fashion. We had handed the Yankees their first home loss during a World Series since 1996. Back in Yankee Stadium for Game 6, even though the Marlins were leading the series 3-2, the Bronx Bombers were still heavily favored. But as fate would have it, the series didn't make it to 7 games. In Game 6, Jack McKeon's tactics were nothing short of brilliant. He decided to start our 23-year-old ace, Josh Beckett, with only 3 days of rest, an unheard-of choice in baseball. Usually, starting pitchers require 4 to 5 days between starts. To get Beckett's mind off baseball for a few hours that afternoon, I had taken him to Barney's New York, the former high-end department store on Madison Avenue in Manhattan, to buy some shirts. I told him his wardrobe needed an upgrade. But Beckett had his own way of releasing the pressure before a World Series start, with a unique pregame ritual that I hadn't seen before. When I arrived at the stadium, I found him sprawled comfortably on a clubhouse couch, immersed in watching cartoons, and oblivious to his surroundings. I realized then that nothing was going to distract him from winning. As the game began, I sat overwhelmed with emotion next to my security person, John Anderson, who had loyally helped me for years. During one tension-filled moment, John turned and saw the consternation on my face. "Why so serious?" he asked. I explained the weight of this game for me and how a lifetime of memories had come flooding back, a disproportionate number of them involving my late father. The flashback of my dad taking me to my first baseball game in the old Yankee Stadium made me wonder what he would have thought if he could have seen what I was witnessing from my now front row seat. I'll never forget John's reaction. Without hesitation, he elbowed me hard in the stomach and said, "You're about to win the World Series. Why the hell are you thinking about that right now?" At the bottom of the ninth, the Marlins were ahead 2-0. A stone-faced Beckett took to the mound and retired the last three batters for the victory. We won the World Series on that Saturday night, October 25th, at Yankee Stadium. When we got the third and final out, I could only repeat to myself, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." I was told later that the hometown celebration practically stopped traffic on Interstate 95 in Miami. By contrast, on the subway ride back into Manhattan from the Bronx, I was told that it was so quiet, you actually could hear the proverbial pin drop. Beckett's pitching made Jack's risky and unconventional choice of starting him with a mere 3 days' rest seem to be an act of genius, and it was. The complete shutout of the Yankees in the final game made him the first pitcher to accomplish that feat since Jack Morris of the Minnesota Twins did so in 1991. The Marlins also scored the game's only runs on three consecutive two-out singles by Alex Gonzalez, Juan Pierre, and Luis Castillo in the fifth, and Juan Encarnacion's sacrifice fly in the sixth. It's still amazing to recall the opposing lineup. We had beaten future Hall of Fame players Mariano Rivera, Roger Clemens, and Derek Jeter. It was an extremely gratifying experience, but also mind-blowing. We weren't supposed to do this. But isn't that what life is all about? Good things sometimes happen when least expected, and I had learned early on in my life to expect the unexpected. Jack McKeon is without question an exceptional manager and a very special man. He deserves an abundance of credit for his leadership and for the faith he had in his players. This triumph was a capstone to a truly remarkable career. The Marlins' victory that October was a prime example of expecting the unexpected. During the celebratory melee on the infield immediately following our victory, everything was a blur. The occasion was obviously highly emotional, not only for our jubilant team, but also for the New York fans, who were in a state of utter shock and uncharacteristically silent. They were, however, very classy in defeat. As our players rushed the field, John Anderson and I were escorted by a New York City police officer to the Yankee dugout on the first base side. I felt this was my team's time to celebrate, so I did not go onto the field or infringe on their precious moment. Instead, I watched from afar and then entered the Yankee dugout and walked through the underground tunnel behind home plate to the visitors' clubhouse on the third base side and waited for my team. As the jubilant players began streaming off the field, I noticed a figure sitting on a bench opposite the clubhouse entrance. When I got closer, I realized it was Don Larsen, a Yankee legend and one of my childhood heroes, who is still the only player in baseball history to pitch a perfect game in the World Series, which he did in 1956. I had witnessed that game with my father. As a player, Larsen was always generous with his time before and after games, always willing to sign autographs and answer questions from young, inquisitive people like me. It had been more than 5 decades since his historic victory, but he held a special place in my heart for his many kindnesses. As I neared the clubhouse door, he stood up and said, "I wanted to congratulate you and your team on such a wonderful victory," extending his hand in a gentle manner that I will never forget. Larsen, waiting outside our triumphant clubhouse with his message of congratulations from the Yankees, was beyond my comprehension. I briefly shared my memories of him and thanked him profusely. It is sometimes said that life often comes full circle. For me, in that brief moment, the clock had turned back to the beginning. We embraced, and with my emotions almost out of control, I turned and joined the exuberant Marlin celebration. After a raucous, champagne-drenched celebration, I walked through our dugout to the field to pay my respects to the Yankee lore, to what our beloved team had accomplished, and as an homage to my father's inextricable link to my baseball emotions. I took a quiet walk around the bases to savor the moment and drink it all in. Sports Illustrated would later erroneously write that I ran around the bases and slid into home plate in a disrespectful way. Nothing could be further from the truth. At my age, I don't slide very well, and more importantly, I had the utmost respect for everyone involved, including Yankees owner George Steinbrenner, a friend whom I also respected greatly. Sadly, sometimes with the media there is no recourse or opportunity to counter inaccurate reporting. When I arrived home that night, I vividly remember repeating to myself the words that I had said in the stands as the game ended. Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God! And those happened to be the exact words that I had inscribed inside my World Series ring. I remained lost in a haze of so many emotions until I fell asleep. My road to winning the World Series began early, as a child in New York City, avidly watching Yankee games. 5 decades later, I returned to New York with my own Major League team, once again standing at the starting block of my childhood. If one is fortunate, I like to think that dreams can and do come true. So dream big. You never know. Chapter 2. The Art Came Early. Art and architecture create a dialogue between the generations, developing across time. Vincent Scully. My father taught me to love baseball. My mother taught me to love art. She and I began that journey when I was 5 years old. We would spend part of the day in the lush green meadows and tree-lined paths of Central Park, and then, on the way home, my mother would stop at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. What was billed as a quick detour would turn into a slow walk through the collections and exhibitions. My mother particularly liked to linger by the old master paintings. She was a highly intelligent and dedicated secondary school teacher who taught history and economics at a time when women were not often hired in those fields. But art was her personal passion. She took me not just to museums, but to galleries and auction rooms. The times when my father accompanied us, I remember her doing most of the discussing while my father did all the listening. One day, she returned home with a small Rembrandt etching. She had carefully saved her teacher's salary to purchase the work from an art gallery, and suddenly, the artist whose work she had coveted in the museum now held a place of pride on our living room wall. This moment began my own journey of collecting. I still have the etching as a memory and reminder of the woman who first inspired my eye. It never occurred to me, or to my parents, that I could not love both baseball and beautiful art, and at least once my mother's eye for beautiful objects saved my sports future. The sidewalks outside our home in the Yorkville section of Manhattan on East 86th Street were not large enough for a baseball diamond, but they were perfect for punch ball, a New York street game which is played exactly like the name suggests, a hard rubber ball punched with one's fist instead of a wooden bat. Once, I executed a perfect punch, sending the ball straight into the third-story window of a neighbor. The police were summoned and went directly to my parents' apartment while I sat in the street, nervously awaiting the outcome. Luckily, the police officer also admired antique furniture, and he started discussing antiques with my parents rather than the broken window. When our neighbors moved, no one was happier than my father, who enjoyed watching our punchball games from our third-floor window. but my sister, who was 3 years younger than me and undoubtedly my biggest fan, always rooted for my team. We were a close, tight-knit family of four. At Stuyvesant High School, my love of sports had an opportunity to flower. I was both the sports editor for the school newspaper and editor-in-chief of a sports magazine called Box Seat, which I founded. I also played second base for the school baseball team. I was small for my age, so I had no chance to be a power hitter, but I was a solid infielder. On several occasions, I was more than solid. During my junior year, I made an unassisted triple play. With players on first and second base, the opposing team attempted a double steal. As both runners took off, I caught the batter's sinking line drive, stepped on second base, and instead of throwing to first, I chased down the runner and tagged him out. As one of the fastest players on the team, I was well suited for the chase. At 17, I applied to four colleges: Columbia, Union, Trinity, and Yale. Trinity College was by far my first choice. Each summer, my family rented a house in the village of Lake Shinnerock in upstate New York. My sister and I would remain in the country with my mother, while my father, an attorney, returned to Manhattan during the week. The summer of my junior year, I met a Trinity graduate who was a neighbor in Lake Shinnerock. He sang the praises of his college experience, so much so that by the time my parents and I traveled to Hartford to visit Trinity, I was primed to be very impressed. On the way home, I told my parents I would only consider attending Trinity. They listened, and then suggested we stop briefly in New Haven to see Yale, since it was on our way. I didn't even want to get out of the car, but my mother insisted, and we walked around the old campus. I remained adamantly uninterested. Months later, my college acceptance letters arrived. I was accepted at Columbia, at Union, and at Yale, and rejected at Trinity. This was a blessing in disguise. My Yale education would have a defining influence on the rest of my life. While I was at Yale, my parents encouraged me to concentrate on a pre-medical education so that I could become a physician or even a surgeon. During one of my first days in the zoology laboratory, we were assigned to study the cells of a live palmetto bug. I was instructed to immerse my laboratory specimen in water. Instead, I was the only student in the class whose science experiment literally got away from him. Being a true New Yorker, I instinctively swatted the palmetto bug and killed it with my shoe. About 2 weeks later, I received a bill for $25 from the bursar's office for my dead bug. That's when I decided that my nascent medical career was over. Yale had a required core curriculum, which, as fate would have it, included taking at least one history course. I was not especially interested in general American or European history, but art history sounded more intriguing, and I figured perhaps it would help me understand the works I had seen at the Met with my mother. The general art history course was also well known, even outside Yale, and was taught by leading scholars, including Vincent Scully. I registered, and it was not an exaggeration to say that this course changed my life. By the end of my freshman year, I had decided to major in art history. The conversation with my parents about my choice was met with silence on the other end of the phone. Was their expensive investment in Yale going toward the pursuit of a questionable future career? Later, my mother and father admitted their profound anxiety. What on earth would their son do with that kind of education? As a parent now, I can understand their concern. But I also know the importance of encouraging one's passion. I soon realized the value of having a good personal library for my studies and embarked on what became a lifelong interest in collecting art reference books. A fellow student was unwittingly a great help. Yale picked up bulky refuse on Wednesday mornings. Almost every Tuesday night, my upstairs dormitory neighbor discarded a stack of books on the front steps of our dorm. I'm not sure why he didn't keep his books, but it turned out to be the perfect way for me to start my library. That neighbor was Jack Hines, heir to the famed food products empire, and we became friends. He was a popular United States senator from Pennsylvania when he was tragically killed in a terrible aviation accident in 1991.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?